From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Peter Fonda. He plays a grizzled bounty hunter in an update of the classic Western 310 to Yuma. Fonda's breakout role was in the 1969 counterculture classic Easy Rider, and he earned an Oscar nomination for Yulee's Gold. He'll tell us about his films, his famous father, and about watching Westerns as a kid and making them as an adult. Also, the role of sarcasm in American English. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg has that story. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross.
So, boys, where are we headed?
Taking to the 310 to Yuma day after tomorrow.
Shouldn't have told him that.
Relax, friend. Now if we get separated, I know where to meet up.
That's Russell Crowe and Peter Fonda from the upcoming Western 310 to Yuma. It's a new take on the 1957 film based on an Elmore Leonard story. The plot centers on a desperate effort to get captured outlaw Ben Wade, played by Russell Crowe, to a prison train at the town of Contention. The film is directed by James Mangold and also stars Christian Bale and Ben Foster. Our guest Peter Fonda plays a veteran bounty hunter named Byron McElroy, who harbors a burning hatred of the outlaw Wade. Peter Fonda has a special fondness for Westerns, having seen his father, Henry Fonda, in so many. He's directed two himself. As an actor, Peter Fonda's played a wide range of characters in a long Hollywood career. He earned two Oscar nominations nearly 30 years apart, one as a writer for Easy Rider, the counterculture classic he also starred in with Dennis Hopper, and the other for acting in Yulee's Gold. Among his other films are The Wild Angels, The Trip, Dirty Mary, Crazy Larry, The Passion of Ayn Rand, and The Limey. Well, Peter Fonda, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
You're at a point in your career where I'm sure you can kind of take your pick of a lot of projects. Why did you pick this one, 310 to Yuma?
Well, actually, I picked James Mangold. I like Jim's work. Girl Interrupted, Walk the Line, Copland, his first film, Heavy. This is a director you want to pay attention to. I knew it was 310 to Yuma, and I knew the original Western itself, and I love Westerns. But Mangold wasn't keen on me playing the role. As friends of mine who work with him said, he thinks you're too laconic. I said, oh, so I met him. I went right away and met him, and he saw I had lots of energy, and I went for the gusto. And I got the gig. And while we were prepping to shoot in Santa Fe, New Mexico, I was in his office. And you dropped a line here. I think it's really kind of a cool line. Well, I wrote in here, sure as hell can ride out. It did like a John Wayne. Well, I wrote in here, Pilgrim, but sure as hell can ride out. He looked at me, dropped his jaw. He said, oh, my God, that's perfect. Play it just like that. Make sound come to you. Meaning, in other words, don't project for sound. Make them come and catch you. Because I find there's more power when you understate things than when you overstate them.
Right. You know, it's funny you mentioned that line because as I saw the film, I thought, wow, that sounded like a little echo of John Wayne there.
Well, and also
the John Wayne moment in the movie.
And I hate to give it away, but you can't miss it when Charlie Prince, played by Ben Foster, brilliantly played by Ben Foster, shoots me in the gut. Oh, no, he comes up to me. Before he shoots me, he said, morning, Pinkerton. Name's Charlie Prince. Reckon you've heard of me. I said, well, I've heard of a bald-up whore named Charlie Princess. That you, Missy? I mean, how more Duke can you get without adding Pilgrim to it?
Right.
And Mangold let it go. He put it in there. I thought it was so cool.
And there were things besides words here. I mean, you get shot in this stage robbery, which sort of sets the plot in
motion. Well, now you gave that one up.
Well, I think that's early enough that that's not a big revelation. But your character is a guy who has felt a bullet before.
That's true.
He gets taken to the town doctor in Brisby, or what passes for a town doctor in Brisby. And I wonder if you want to describe that scene, because that's quite a moment.
Well, it is a moment. It's kind of interesting, too. And let me get ahead of that for a moment by saying, in some of the screenings, people have asked me, well, you got gut shot. How come you can walk around and live so long?
Yeah.
And I said, well, I've taken lead, and I really have.
You, Peter Fonda, have taken lead?
Peter Fonda have taken lead. And while we were shooting, I said to everybody, who else here on the set's taking lead? Because Jim was saying, I want you to do this. I said, uh-uh. It's as you wrote it. He just grunts. It stings a bit, and then your body goes into shock. And when Alan Tudyk, who plays Doc, he digs it out of me. It's not that deep inside me because the bullet hasn't done that much damage. Number two, I will bleed to death, but not before I get Ben Wade on that train to Yuma.
Now, the real story here is, well, a story we've got to hear is Peter Fonda taking lead. When did you take lead?
A month shy of my 11th birthday. A stupid shooting accident, and the bullet went off right in front of me, right close by. It was a pistol. And
who shot it?
Me. And a bullet hit my rib cage and tumbled through the tip of my liver, blew at the top of my stomach, and then went through the middle of my left kidney. And I knew I was dying, It did sting at first, and I went into shock, didn't feel a thing. And as I was being taken care of at the Austin Hospital in Austin, New York, at that time it was right next to Sing Sing Prison, interesting. You know the phrase, timing is everything?
Mm-hmm.
Here's the proof of that. As they were trying to trace the path of the bullet, they kept running into my heart. And they felt, because there was so much blood in my body cavity, that the bullet had pierced my heart, or at least my abdominal aorta. And the heart being a muscle that pumps, as the bullet was tumbling through, having hit my rib cage and therefore starting the tumble, the heart was in the contracting mode and went tumbling by the heart. Timing is everything. So I'm here telling you this story.
In a different piece of the different timing of the heart stroke, well, the bullet catches the heart and you aren't here.
Yeah, right. But yeah, well, you see, and my family thought I was trying to commit suicide because my mother had just done that the year previous, not even a year before.
You were 10, but you didn't know at the time, I believe.
No,
right?
No, I was told she died.
She was
in fact,
away.
That she had died of a heart attack, and they forgot that they didn't tell me, and I didn't learn about my mother's death. Every 5 years, something new came up. It was a pretty rough time for me up until I was 25 and found out the really gruesome details.
You know, I may mangle the quote here, but I think it was Teddy Roosevelt who said something like, "There's nothing more exhilarating than being shot without consequence." Do you think taking a bullet when you were 11 changed your life in some fundamental way?
No, but it changed everybody's life around me in a very fundamental way. As
the way they saw you and cared for you, you mean?
No. Well, probably that too. My maternal grandmother and my sister were waiting in this very special little waiting room off the operating room. And the doctor, Charles Clark Sweet, came in with all my blood over his apron and said, "I'm sorry, Mrs. Seymour, but there's nothing more we can do for him. His heart stopped three times and he's lost too much blood and he stopped breathing." So for 48 seconds, my sister thought that her brother was dead. And then one of his assistants stuck his head in and said, "No, we got his heart started again." And so hence I'm here talking to you in this wonderful NPR radio show.
You know, I wanted to ask you, you know, your dad did Westerns. I'm sure you watched them when you were a kid. And I'm always find that when I watch a Western, it's a kind of film that really transports me to another place. I mean, because we, you know, there's this gorgeous Western scenery, but it takes us back to a time when there was more lawlessness and, you know, at times, you know, capricious savagery.
Was there more lawlessness than now? Or capricious savagery? I don't know.
Well,
I look at Westerns, as I do some science fiction, if they're good films, as a way of showing us today, showing ourselves without us knowing we're looking in the mirror until maybe a few beats later, like maybe a couple of weeks, maybe a year, where you see something and say, "My God, that was like that scene."
Right.
And then you might think about it a little further and say, "That's how my neighbor feels about life, and that's what's happening to this fella down the road." And I've seen some pretty darn good Westerns. My dad was in a couple of them, extraordinarily good ones. Character-driven, like Oxbow Incident,
right.
And character-action, like My Darling Clementine, two of my favorite Westerns there. Others being The Searchers, Red River, you know. And people don't give John Wayne enough credit for his ability as an actor. And so when he got the Academy Award, he said, "You mean all I had to do was put a patch over my eye?" I thought that was a very funny gig. I thought he was right. Because
that was her True Grit?
Yeah. You know, right. And the Duke learned how to play his character a gazillion ways. And it worked, and remarkably well, you know, to play the kind of character that was not usual for his role in The Searchers or Red River. You know, those are great, great Westerns. But they also carry a certain amount of quality to today's life, of conflict of father, son, you know,
right.
All those types of things. The conflict of character in Oxbow Incident, mm-hmm. The injustice of men, the lawlessness of the group madness. We're going to hang these people regardless because they look bad. Well, what did we do in Easy Rider? We didn't get knocked off because we smuggled some
right.
sort of, we never said what that substance was across the border. We got knocked off because they didn't like the way we looked.
Right.
We represented something they couldn't understand, so they had to kill it. And these are the ways we can take an idiom and bend it a bit, tweak it a bit, shape it up a little bit more, and make something different out of it. Because after all, a Western is a Western, and it fulfills certain entities. There's the good and the bad. Well, we have the gray in here, and we're able to play that very well.
My guest is Peter Fonda. His new film is 310 to Yuma. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining me, my guest is Peter Fonda. His new film is 310 to Yuma. You know, after you made Easy Rider, I mean, which was just this enormous success and an iconic film, you kind of had the world by the tail, and you chose to direct a Western, The Hired Hand, which has kind of had a bit of a comeback. I mean, it's film festivals and art houses.
Oh, no, huge comeback.
Yeah, yeah.
You're making money with a film now.
Well, that's great.
But I didn't intend to go out and direct that. It was a script that was given to me in 1969 whilst I was dubbing Easy Rider into French, German, and Italian. And I read it, and as I was reading it, I saw all of it. And I thought, well, I'll produce this and star in it like I did with Easy Rider, except I wrote Easy Rider. And Alan Sharp's script was just beautiful. And as I saw each scene, I thought, how do I tell a director this is how I want you to shoot it? Because that kind of takes away the director's gig. Stage is an actor's medium. Film is the director's medium. And television is the writer's producer's medium. And how do I do that? How could I go against the director? So I thought, well, I better direct it.
And I wanted to play a scene from it, which I think really illustrates that well. Let's listen to this. This is from The Hired Hand, directed by my guest Peter Fonda. And we're going to hear, just to set this up, and you play this this adventurer, Harry, who is sort of tired of life on the road, and he and his friend, Archie, played by Warren Oates, go back. Your character, Harry, decides he's going to go back to the wife and child he
left.
Go home.
And we know already from literature, you can't go home again.
Right. And she essentially says, you can work out in the shed and do some chores, and we'll see.
Yeah.
And then right before the scene we're going to hear, he has heard talk in town that his wife, Hannah, who is played by Verna Bloom, that she had been sleeping with some of the hired hands while she was out there living alone. In this scene, you're in the kitchen and you confront her with this. This is from The Hired Hand. Let's listen.
They said you slept with all your hired hands. You hired men to sleep with.
God, what do you know about it?
How many?
Does it matter?
Of course it matters.
You were long gone before anybody got into my bed. And don't think that's because I was hankering after you. I wasn't. That was as long as I could stand it. I walked about this room on nights like this going crazy for a man, any man, didn't matter. And sometimes when there was a man out there, he knew about it and he'd come in. And sometimes I'd have him or he'd have me, whatever suits you. But not all of them. And not every time I wanted to. And when a season's work was over, I'd pay him off, no matter how well he'd worked or how well he'd pleased me. Because the man that's in a woman's bed thinks he's her boss. And sooner or later, they'd have tried to move their tackle out of the shed and in here, and I didn't want that. Because I'd already had one man in here, and I didn't want another.
And that's Verna Bloom and my guest Peter Fonda from the movie Hired Hand, directed by Peter Fonda. It's a wonderful scene. And this film really is about gender roles in the West.
And never have you heard a woman face down a man in that way, especially in the gender-driven West. That was remarkable stuff. That was all on the page. We didn't change any of that stuff. It was just, like, delicious.
Well, she is terrific. And you know, there's another scene where Warren Oates is sitting on
the back porch.
Yeah. Right, your buddy. And this is the scene where she's sort of, again, mulling over this idea that women have physical needs too, and she met her needs. And Warren Oates kind of, they talk about this, and then the scene ends, and this is where the director comes in, and we see that he has his hand on her foot.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit about making that scene. What was going on there?
Well, you know, once again, a delicious scene, once again, about a woman and her needs and a man. Warren played wisdom as far as I was concerned, and he deserved to be with her because he understood her better than my character did. And in talking about them, in this interplay between them, she says, "You think I'm hard, don't you?" "Well, I probably am." And he said, "Well, that's not for me to decide, ma'am." And you don't see what he does. You just see his shoulder moves a bit because I play it in a closer shot, although we did it in a master. I didn't want you to see what it's doing until the reveal is coming back out of that shot. You see him take his hand off her bare foot. And that's a very tender thing to do. It's very, very personal to touch somebody's foot, barefoot, pull it off. And the interesting thing about that is we're shooting, and it was a long scene, and I wanted to know we had enough film in the camera always. And there was this music, and I yelled, "Would you just turn off the radio? You know, we're working out here. Who's listening to music?" Like, it was rock and roll. And then we start again. I was apologetic to the actors, and we start going again, this very quiet, very intense scene. And then it comes this rock and roll through. And I said, "Dang it!" Now, of course, I used much heavier.
Right.
"Turn off those radios. I can't. This is..." And then third time, I just listened to the music, and I realized what it was. It was the soundtrack from Easy Rider.
Coming from where?
About 5 miles away across the river from us was a drive-in theater showing that movie, and the wind and stuff was just carrying that music into us. And it was just like, that movie is paying for this one, because I didn't pay myself anything to act, direct, and produce the show. I did it for free.
So what did you do about the Easy Rider score over this tender interaction between these actors?
I just waited till the show ended. Then we started working again.
My guest is Peter Fonda. His new film is 310 to Yuma. You know, you got an Academy Award nomination for Yuli's Gold, which is just a terrific film. And if anybody in the audience hasn't gotten around to it yet, it's a wonderful video rental.
Thank you very much.
You play this, a beekeeper and a widower whose son is in jail, whose wife has died, obviously. His son is in jail, and his son's wife is strung out on drugs, and the grandchildren are staying with him. It's a really kind of powerfully understated performance, I think.
Yeah. Interesting. That's what the critics were remarking about a lot, this incredibly understated performance. I thought to myself, well, where the hell were they when they saw Easy Rider? Because what did I do in that film?
Oh, it's exactly.
Wow.
I was going to tell you. I hear this Captain America a little bit in that.
Beautiful, man. That's far out. Well, throwing away lines is the way I like to do it. You know, punching up too much, you tend to overplay it, and it becomes predictable. And when you play it down low and slower, it becomes less predictable. Something that John Wayne, we were talking earlier, right, learned how to do very well. And he has that kind of voice, and he talks that way. But remember how he walks. He has a certain kind of walk. He was taught how to do all those things because he was a beautiful young actor when he was a young man. And people saw that, and whoever it was that helped him through that taught him how to walk a certain way by having him turn his feet in just a little bit and put his toes down first. Huh. That gave that special walk to him, and teaching him how to speak slower. So all the notes I make in my scripts, slow it down.
Right.
Play it, state it. Don't ask a question, make a statement. All these little notes that I give myself, which is my trick as an actor that I do.
Yeah, the pacing in those scenes are really great. One of the things that I like about that film is the way your occupation as a beekeeper is a really important part of it. And what's interesting about that is, this is a film about difficult interactions among very troubled characters. But in real life, we spend a lot of our time working. We don't just have these interior
true
angst among people. And this film really shows your character, Yuli Jackson, struggling with the physical and financial demands of his beekeeping business. And you really learn a little bit about beekeeping.
True.
And I think that gives it a sense of context that really makes it all work.
Victor Nunez wrote a brilliant script. When I read that script, I was in tears at the end. And I looked up at the roof of my cabin in Montana, and I literally said, "I'd like to thank the members of the Academy." But I said to Victor, I said, "Well, his name is Ulysses, isn't it?" And in Ulysses, Wasn't Ulysses' wife named Penelope? And in Ulysses Gold, my wife was Penelope. And who was the young woman who was causing all the trouble? Helen, my daughter-in-law, Helen of Troy.
Of course.
So this is, I said, if you're a conduit for that great mythology from Greek history, if you're in that bit of a thing, grab hold of that brain and take on to it, because that's where I'm going.
Right.
And, you know, Ulysses has this long journey. It takes him a long time to get back to his island where he lived. And
Homer's Ulysses.
Homer's Ulysses. And Ulysses Jackson takes a long time getting back from Vietnam. He spends 10 years in L.A., you know, in the VA hospital working on his bum leg, and finally comes home. His wife's been dead now. As I've said, his son's in trouble. His daughter-in-law, Helen's causing this. And he's got his two little grandchildren. He has to reinvent a life. It's the hard work Ulysses Jackson does just to make a living, and it's not a big living.
Peter Fonda. His new film, 310 to Yuma, opens September 7th. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Now if a six turned out to be nine, oh, I don't mind. Oh, I don't mind. If all the hippies cut off all their hair, oh, I don't care.
White collar conservative flashing down the street, pointing their plastic finger at me. They'll soon my kind of drop and die, but I'm gonna wave my green flag.
Support for NPR comes from Bantam Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Social Intelligence, The New Science of Human Relationships by Daniel Goleman, author of Emotional Intelligence. From Anne and John Herman, supporting City Year and the young adults who dedicate a year of their lives to community service and leadership development, cityyear.org. And from TIAA Cref, putting the values of a .org to work for the financial future of those who serve the greater good. That's powerof.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, yeah, right. Linguist Jeff Nunberg explores the use of sarcasm from junior high to adulthood. And we continue our conversation with Peter Fonda. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. We're speaking with actor Peter Fonda. He's in a new Western with Russell Crowe and Christian Bale, 310 to Yuma. He co-wrote and starred in the 1969 classic Easy Rider and got an Oscar nomination for his role in Ulysses Gold. You know, I thought we should talk a little bit about the Steven Soderbergh film, The Limey, which you starred in. It's just a great film where you play Terry Valentine, who's this very successful record producer, made a lot of money from 60s records. Kind of an odious character, right?
That's a nice way. I would have used the Scumbag is the phrase.
Right.
You can cut it out. It's no problem for me.
No, I think that will pass. But I thought we could hear a cut of this. And this is a scene where you are – one of the things you do is date women much, much younger than yourself. And,
yeah.
And here you're playing the stunning young woman played by Amelia Hindley, who has this unusual name of Adhara. And she's popping out of the swimming pool in this
right.
incredible home you have in L.A. So let's listen. This is from the film The Limey.
Adhara, I remember telling your parents, if you're looking for a name, you can't go wrong with a constellation.
Well, I used to hate it. Now I like it.
Well, it could be worse. They could have called you Reticulum, Pleiades. God, you're beautiful. Is there anything in this world that you want or need?
Well, I want to know why you need that scary man in your house.
Gordon? He's been with me for years. He's not as tough as he looks.
And what good is he?
Heard of loyalty?
Yeah. I'm loyal to things that make me happy.
Well, my thing?
Well, you're certainly not a person.
I'm not.
No? You're not specific enough to be a person. You're more like, a vibe.
God, I'm glad we're having this little chat. Come here. Get out of the pool.
And that's Peter Fonda and Amelia Hindley from the film The Limey. What's fascinating little look at this character that you're playing. The interesting thing, of course, is that he knew her parents and helped
yeah.
name her. And now he's dating her.
Is that sick? That is truly sick.
You know, but, you know, I read so much about what a loathsome guy this is. But when I actually saw the film, you know, you play him with this easy charm. I mean, he could be likable.
Actually, the fellow who wrote the script, Lem Dobbs, and he's married to one of my daughter's best friends. I took all the kids out to dinner quite a few years before we shot that film. And Lem reached across the table and said, "You know, I'm writing this screenplay for you." And I thought in my mind, "Oh yeah, well, I'll believe that when that script crosses my desk." And when it finally came across my desk, I said, "Whoa." And I came to Lem and I said, "Lem, is this how you see me? Is this scumbag record producer, this guy who's just totally evil in a way?" He said, no, that's not it. "But I've seen you go through stuff that's so bad and come out like the rose, and you just do it with such grace. Even no matter how bad it is, you can take it through and come out gracefully." And I thought, well, I'll go with that. You know, I'll take that bit of the character and run with it.
Right. Well, in this film, I mean, the Limey is not you. It's this English ex-con who comes looking for you because you had dated his daughter who has died, and he...
At my hand, basically.
Yeah. At least that's certainly his suspicion and wants to... It's about a kind of gathering confrontation with you. And of course, he's played by Terrence Stamp and is just so effective and scary and real. Just talk a little bit about your interaction with him.
There's a foreground of that. This is absolutely hysterical. I met Stamp. I was in Rome. My oldest sister was getting married, and I went to Rome, the only member of the family to go there, to give her away, to, you know, be her father. And after that wedding, I was just cut loose for a while, and somebody came up to me and said, "Look, there's this festival in Taormina, Sicily, and Fellini's going to be there and Terrence Stamp. And we'll pay you $10,000 cash to go down there." And wow, you know, in 1965, 10 grand was a lot of dough. It's still a lot of dough. And I thought, great. And Fellini and Terrence Stamp on top of this is a show. Well, Fellini didn't show. Terrence and I were there. And of course, we got smashed every night. And we would do this little crawl. I call it the swimming, my version of the swimming man. We would go from one person's backyard to another, just crawling over walls and falling into it. And these people would have those little rollaway bars that would come out by the pool in the daytime and then be rolled under something at night. And they all had, you know, booze on there, wine and stuff. We'd roll them out. We'd just drink their stuff and sit on the wall looking at the Eastern Mediterranean with the sun.
Unbeknownst to the property owner.
Oh, absolutely.
You're just wandering in and helping yourself.
Just helping ourselves and getting smashed. And then in that one moment, watching the sun come out of the Eastern Mediterranean, we promised each other we would make a film together. I just didn't know it would take 38 years.
And you did, right?
No, 33 years, actually. 33 years. Yeah, we did it. And they were delicious characters for both Terrence and myself. And Steven Soderbergh, the director, used stuff from our own pasts and put them in the present of this.
Actual flashbacks of old movies, right? An old film that he had done, right?
Poor Cow. And for me, an actual story from my book, Don't Tell Dad, about hitting a deer on the highway on my motorcycle. And it was being able to do those things inside that character and tell that story inside the character's own idiom. That was a tremendous thing. It was a revelation to me. And I loved it. You don't often get to do that.
You know, it's interesting that you tell this story with Terrence Stamp back from the mid-60s recall it so vividly because, you know, in a lot of ways, you are an iconic figure of the 60s. I mean, Easy Rider, we're coming up on the 40th anniversary of that. And it's, you know, it's just a huge part of American culture. And, you know, you don't look so different. I mean, you're still really thin and you're wearing the shades. How much is the guy that made that film?
Well, actually,
still in you. I mean, how much have you changed?
These are corrective lenses.
Okay, that's one difference.
But from way back when, I was wearing them because my father hated me wearing these dark glasses, aviators, just like these. And so I would wear them just to bug him. And having done that then in life and then putting that in film, like Wild Angels and Easy Rider, I have no vanity about having to wear glasses. So I need to wear glasses now, but people recognize me with the glasses. And if I smile, it's a dead giveaway. If I don't have the glasses on, they don't see me, but I feel more comfortable behind the glasses. When I'm on screen, I don't get to do that unless I've written the role.
A lot of us, I mean, I'm 54, and when I think about things that I did in my 20s, I sort of connect with some of them, but they don't define who I am. At age 28, you made this film, Easy Rider, which is this iconic film in American cinema. And I'm wondering what it's like to kind of have so much of who you are be associated with this thing you did decades ago.
Well, you know, at first, about 10 years into it, I was a little bit bored about it and annoyed that they weren't seeing these other things that I had done. And then I realized it had gone beyond what I thought it would ever do. I knew it was shaking the cage, and I knew it would be successful. I did not realize it would become an icon. It would become one of the top 100 movies of 100 years, that AFI award, mm-hmm. that all kinds of things were put on that film around the world. The motorcycle, which I built. I built the motorcycles that I rode and Dennis rode. I bought four of them from Los Angeles Police Department. I love the political incorrectness of that. But, you know, there's no subtitle that says these are LAPD cop bikes, you know. And five black guys from Watts helped me build buildings. This was very politically incorrect. And Watts in 1968 was not a place for a white boy to be, let alone have him help me build these motorcycles. And that motorcycle has become an icon. Me and that flag in my back has become an icon. And by the way, I got the idea for the flag in my back from a John Wayne movie about the Flying Tigers.
Oh, really?
And I thought, that's a great image. Sometime I'm going to use that. And so many years later, I thought, that's when the image, but it's not that flag. It's going to be the U.S. flag. I'm going to carry this flag across the country. This is going to be tough for the audience to try to get around this, who I am carrying this flag. And that was a moment there for me to have done that. And not realizing that motorcycle, that image of the flag, and then me carrying it and what I was in the film, that would become iconic. And I now have to live with it in a way that's better than I thought it would be. Because it means so much to so many people. Far be it from me to say, oh, you know what I've done? That was my eighth film. I've done 70 since then. Give me a break. And there's people who say, you know, I love Dirty Mary, Crazy Larry. I mean, they have their special ones and their favorite ones, and that's great too. But eventually, most of the questions will come out about Easy Rider. And I can't get annoyed about that. That means something to an actor, to a filmmaker, to a screenwriter, that what you've done when you were 28 still carries as much weight.
My guest is Peter Fonda. He's in the new film 310 to Yuma. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining me, we're speaking with Peter Fonda. His new film is a Western, 310 to Yuma. It's interesting, you know, you grew up in a Hollywood family and went into acting. Well,
no, we did not know we were a Hollywood family.
Because your father was so distant, right?
Well, not that part. We didn't know we were part of Hollywood. These people would come to the house, the Duke, Jimmy Stewart, yeah. Ward Bond, Randolph Scott. You know, they were just people.
When you're a kid, you don't know.
No, we didn't go to movies. The first movie I saw, other than the little home movies of the Castle Films, newsreels and stuff like that, was a film my father did called Chad Hanna. But I didn't, I mean, he looked like my dad, but my dad couldn't be in a circus with Linda Darnell. He was out in the Pacific fighting the Second World War. So I'd wondered, who was that guy who sounded and looked like my father? So I went as a little guy, I went in pounding on the screen, Daddy, Daddy, Daddy. My mother had to take me out of the screening room and explain to me that wasn't my father, that was Chad Hanna. I went home, I wondered, why are all these pictures of Chad Hanna around our house? You know, why is Chad Hanna posing like my father? I don't get this. This wasn't something I could really put together. And we never saw him in any in the family films. Well, that was because Chad was operating the camera. He wasn't in the shots. And at a break at school, his break from the war, he came home on a leave, and he came to the school to pick me and my sisters up. And I didn't know. I just saw the big black Buick limo that was a family car, and out stepped Chad Hanna. Well, I beat feet, dude. I hid in the bushes. And I was such a skinny little kid, I could get way inside the bushes, and nobody could get to me. Now, think about my father's point of view in this. Even though
literally don't know that this guy is your father.
He's Chad Hanna.
Right.
And what about my father who's come home and come to pick us up, and his only son refuses to see him or deal anything with him? But then I thought, well, is this retribution for the fact that he never talked to us? I mean, there were long, cold silences at those tables, and I'd look at James and say, what did you do? What did you do? You know, we didn't know.
Well, you know, I know that you've written about the difficult relationship with your father in the book that you wrote, and I'm wondering, were you determined, I mean, maybe this is obvious, but to have a different kind of relationship with your kids?
I mean, I thought about that for sure. But I tried not to do the comparative because it would have been too easy for me to fall into just overdoing it then, to overcompensate for what I didn't have. And unfortunately, what I didn't have colored me more than what I wanted to do in life.
What do you mean, what you didn't have?
Well, what I lacked in a family was not something I could make up for in my own family as well as I would have liked to have done. Never having said that, my father was not a mean person. No, he never hit me, really. He spanked me once. He just didn't know how to show love. But we didn't understand. He was incredibly shy. And so he would show love through anger or deep silence with angry looks. And his background in religion was Christian Science. So, you know, if you have a problem, you don't have a cold. It's something wrong with you and God. And, man, you know, we got measles and stuff like that, and it was not that we really had an illness. It was something wrong with us and God. That quickly shut me off from organized religion right away. You know? Wow. And I didn't realize that my dad could sit next to somebody in a bus and talk their ear off, a stranger. But when it came to us, he couldn't do anything. He was most comfortable on the stage creating character, because in character he could do all this talking that he couldn't do in his own life with his own family.
You know, if I heard this, I've read that later in your life, when you had an active and successful career in film, that he would sometimes congratulate you, but never in person through an agent or through a note.
Well, yeah, to a degree. When he came to see Easy Rider, he was not so sure about it. He said, well, son, I'm not sure this is going to play. We don't know where you're going. I said, well, Dad, yeah, we do. Dennis says, I'm going down to Mardi Gras. I'm going to get myself a Mardi Gras queen. Oh, I can't wait to get some of my hands on that food. Well, that's a little thin, son. I don't know. I said, well, Dad, why don't you just take the trip with us? Why don't you just look at discover what we discovered, because that's what we're up to. I don't know, son. That's asking the audience to do an awful lot. But he was from a different era of film,
right. And
he was used to a certain kind of storytelling. Even though his films were remarkable, it was a different way of doing it, because we didn't have these grandiose speeches or stuff. It was just us. And, of course, it was tremendous success. And he was proud of that, but he didn't know how to tell me. Then he worked for me one day in a film I directed, another Western, but it was a modern Western, 1951, with Brooke Shields. She was tremendous. He worked one day for me. And about a week and a half afterwards, he sent me a letter, maybe the fifth letter he ever sent me in his life. And in that letter, he was grousing about the beard he had because it wasn't as good and so forth and so forth. Then he said, you know, in my 41 years of making motion pictures, I've never seen a crew so devoted to the director. And you're a very good director, son. And I love you very much. Your dad. Hmm. Now, I would not have gotten that letter had it not been for the entire company. And that's my hallmark as a filmmaker. When I'm in charge with it, producing, directing, whatever that is, if I'm in charge of it, I try to develop a company. Because in a company form, we can push what we have to do. And they all have to be involved with it. There's no such thing. It's not my department. That is not a phrase that happens on one of my sets.
And your dad saw that thing that you had with the crew, and that meant a lot to you.
Yeah, and then after that, I realized he hadn't seen The Hired Hand. So I screened that for him, and his comment of that, well, that's my kind of Western. So that was great, you know. And at the end of his life, he was dying. He opened up his eyes. He'd been in some sort of another place, and he looked at his fifth wife and blinking his eyes, one eye closed and open, blinking his eyes like a drunk trying to find the right part of the path to walk down. His big, blue, beautiful eyes, didn't say a thing to her, looked at his firstborn, my sister, Jane, blinking his eyes, didn't see a thing, and then looked at her husband, then Tom Hayden, whom I refer to as the commie prevert, didn't say a thing, and then looked at me, both eyes opened up, and he said, I want you to know, son, I love you very much, and laid his head down and died. And that pretty much took care of any problems I would have had with my father. They just passed right away. Huh. And that wasn't a problem in my life anymore. I mean, I can remember and tell you about it, but I don't carry angst about it in my heart.
You know, I did want to ask about your daughter, Bridget, who did pursue acting and is really good at it. And wondered, having been through the business, did you have any particular hopes or fears for her getting into acting?
Man, you were leading me some of the best stories. You're leading me right. This is so cool. I promised my kids I'd be at all their graduations because nobody showed up in mine. You know, what was I doing magna cum laude if nobody was going to show up, right? And so I was doing a film in Germany. I'd rented a jet from Essen in Germany, for just outside Munich, to Paris. Took the Concorde to New York, rented a jet from New York to L.A. and showed up 45 minutes before her graduation. And she saw me, and I could see the relief and the wonderful look on her face. Afterwards, we're walking arm in arm, and she said, Dad, I want to be an actor. Don't you ever say that again. Dad, it's a verb, not a noun. Where are you going to study acting? UCLA? I said, no, that's Tanning 101. And USC's the theory of Tanning 101. If you really want to get into this, you go to Princeton, Yale, or NYU. I'd advise NYU, get into every student film you can, take off-campus courses in acting, because this is a job. You work at this. It is a noun. And she did that, and she understood this is work. And later in an interview I read, the interviewer said, well, of course, this isn't your genes. It's in your genes. Oh, no, this isn't. I work at this. I thought, all right, because it is something we do. It's not genetic. Just because my father, my sister, myself, and my daughter, and my son's a cameraman, are in this business, it's because of proximity. But proximity will only carry you so far. You have to have the goods. When you walk through that door, you have two strikes against you. You have one shot to hit it out of the park, or at least get on base, right? Right. One chance, because if you don't, you're gone. You don't have a shot at it, at getting the role.
Even if you're a Fonda, right?
Nah. Yeah. They may say that's a great selling point to have a Fonda in the film, but man, if you're not a good actor, no matter how many films you've done or how many parents you've got in this business, you don't get that shot. And Jane stepped up to that plate. I started working at it when I was 13 because I wrote my first play when I was 13 because I did not want to play a fair young maiden in another show of the Pirates of Penzance. As I was in an all boys boarding school and somebody had to play a fair young maiden. I was a skinny little effete-looking guy and I was so embarrassed about this because I was almost 10 pounds when I was born. And my father's movie, I can't remember what he was making, but he went hooping and hollering around the set, I'm told, saying, oh boy, I have a fullback for a son. Well, guess what? I was almost 10 pounds when I was 20. So that was a disappointment walking out the door.
Right. Well, it's been great talking to you, Peter Fonda. Thanks so much for coming.
Thank you very much for having me on the show.
Peter Fonda's new film, 310 to Yuma, opens September 7th. Coming up, Jeff Nunberg on sarcasm. This is Fresh Air. What is it that brings out a sarcastic streak in people whenever they talk about improper use of language? Our linguist Jeff Nunberg thinks he's found the origins in eighth grade English class.
Not long ago, Newsweek ran a guest column by an Alabama college professor who was complaining about his students' sloppy writing, one of those familiar language diatribes that seem to come with a system disc. Whenever he sees a student writing, "It goes without saying," or "It's not for me to say," he says, he scribbles on their essays, "Then why say it?" Nobody gets through life without having an English teacher like that, though if you're lucky, you'll get yours out of the way well before you reach college. Mine was Mrs. Bosch in the eighth grade. Let somebody hand in a paper with a sentence, "Having been thrown in the air, the dog caught the stick," and Mrs. Bosch would dispatch it before the entire class with pointed sarcasm. "Why, the poor animal!" And we would crack up, partly out of sadistic pleasure in the humiliation visited on our hapless classmate, and partly because it pleased us to be let in on the joke. Mrs. Bosch's sarcasm was a crucial part of our education as writers, such as it was. Her sharp voice was an inward presence as we scanned our sentences, trying to make sure their meanings at least vaguely coincided with what we were trying to say. And of course, she had our eighth grade number. That's the age when kids are all going a little crazy with the discovery of sarcasm, as they realize the power of echoing somebody else's words or thoughts in a way that makes them sound deluded or foolish. In the schoolyard, sarcasm replaces brute insult, as kids move from "you butthead retard" to "smooth move, guy." And it's their first line of defense against parental authority, as they learn to voice their grudging compliance in a tone that makes their disaffection clear. "Yeah, right, Dad." Adolescent sarcasm can be irritating. That's what it's supposed to be, after all. But we can look on it a little indulgently. After all, what else have 13-year-olds got going for them? But when grown people engage in sarcasm, it can come off as a disconcertingly juvenile bit of nastiness. Yet when the subject of language comes up, a lot of people revert to a tone of keening mockery that hasn't much deepened since they were in middle school. Earlier this year, for example, Dick Cavett wrote a piece about the decline of English in the web-based New York Times Select. Cavett began by warning that we're losing our grip on our glorious English language, and then proceeded to roll off a series of familiar japes about things like the mispronunciations of heinous and nuclear, not to mention that chestnut about literally that my Mrs. Bosch performed for three generations of middle schoolers. The senator literally exploded with laughter, and who cleaned up the mess? When a flight attendant announces, "We will be landing in Chicago momentarily," Cavett says, he enjoys replying, "Will there be time to get off?" Actually, I have trouble imagining how that conversation could take place. I mean, Cavett makes his little witticism, and the flight attendant gives him his look that says, "Excuse me?" And then he has to explain, "Oh, I was merely venturing a joking reference to the prescriptive grammarian's insistence that the adverb momentarily should be used only to signify for a moment and not in a moment." My guess is that if Cavett actually replied to that announcement, it was sotto voce to an imaginary companion. But the gag tells better this way. As Mrs. Bosch understood full well, the point of sarcasm isn't just to humiliate the clueless. It's also for the benefit of an audience who were in on the joke. That's who teenagers are appealing to with their eye rolls, as if they were glancing over to an invisible homie in the other corner of the room. You could sense the same yearning for solidarity among the 800 or so readers who posted online comments to Cavett's piece, almost all of them with a sarcastic take on some usage that sears their ears or has them screaming at their TV set. What do you mean, broad daylight? Could it happen in narrow daylight? As for those who feel badly, I believe they refer to an impaired tactile sense. It's easy to find this sort of thing sophomoric, and even that might involve skipping a grade or two. But it answers to a simple desire for communion with others who know better. And in its own way, it leaves you feeling reassuringly complacent about the state of English. These complaints may always be bracketed by apocalyptic warnings about the imminent collapse of the language, but if the greatest linguistic threats we're facing are things like the confusion of prone and supine and a shaky grasp of the lie-lay distinction, then we'll probably muddle through. It's like hearing somebody warn of grave domestic security threats and then learning that he's concerned about Canadian sturgeon poaching on the U.S. side of Lake Huron. In fact, the inconsequentiality of these issues belies the charges of elitism that critics are always leveling at the Wordanistas. Think of the way Lynn Truss has ridden this shtick to the top of the bestseller lists. Her operatic indignation draws millions of readers into a sense of confraternity with everybody else who got the possessive rule down cold in middle school. And what could be more democratic than that? Language may be infinitely deep and mysterious, but when it comes to using the apostrophe right, you and I can walk hand in hand with Henry James.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist who teaches at the School of Information at the University of California at Berkeley. His latest book, called Talking Right, is now out in paperback. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdit. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Somerset Maugham's novel Of Human Bondage, in stores and online at bn.com. From the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan, information at moma.org. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers, audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the strange relationship between Bobby Kennedy and J. Edgar Hoover. Writer and historian Burton Hirsch has written a new book about the duo. He'll tell us about behind-the-scenes manipulation of Congress and the influence of organized crime in politics. Join us for the next Fresh Air.